This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It takes more, more than a hammer, more than a hammer and nail. It takes more than a hammer and nail to make a house a home, to make a house a home, to make a house a home, to make a house.
Unless you are a farmer or one of the last rugged outdoors adventurers, 90% of your time on Earth is spent inside buildings. We are snails who don't know we are snails.
If you value your sanity, don't go in the house. If you believe in evil, don't go in the house.
Oh, God.
Because the people who live there aren't people anymore. Don't go in the house. But if you do, don't say we didn't warn you.
Naturally, we dream of the perfect home. That's a cheap daydream, all right, but it's expensive to really do it. The real biggest cost, whether you build, buy, or rent, is the energy needed to run all those buildings. 80% of the long-term cost of a building is energy use, not construction. And that is before peak oil and climate pressures really kick in. Our electricity provider here has already announced an increase of 25% over the next 3 years. Given the new oil demand from China and more oil use by exporting countries themselves, the cost of oil is just going to go up and up. Will it reach a point where you have to decide between heating or cooling your house or office and eating? Some of our poorest citizens, well, it's already happening for them. For your personal security in troubled times, and for national security, we need to slash the energy used in buildings. Did I mention that numerous studies show buildings contribute more than a third of carbon emissions to our overloaded atmosphere? I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and it's all about solutions. You will hear a prominent pioneer in the passive house technique. Buildings that use as little as 10% of the energy guzzled by our current structures. I'll interview architect Guido Wimmers and tell you where to download 2 free passive house workshops. You'll get ideas that can revolutionize new building and help guide renovations to existing ones. We'll talk to another construction pioneer, Tom Pitsley. He's been testing a super low-energy house in Massachusetts where the windows grab solar power to heat the home, even in New England winters. Then we'll listen in to another workshop, this time on a net zero building project in Ontario, Canada. Jamie DeSimone explains how to use planet-friendly materials, including lots of straw, to make long-lasting energy misers. Again, you'll be able to download the full workshop for free. The building industry has been key to the economy in many countries, but many of the skyscrapers and carbon copy mansions won't survive peak oil and climate disruption. Already, as I explained in the Radio EcoShock show for June 6, 2008, some of the old structures built during the cheap energy era are being torn down or retrofitted at a huge cost. I'll put a link to that program called Building Madness in my April 1st blog for this show. We can't afford to keep wasting massive amounts of energy. And we can't live in the future climate if we do. Join me in this exploration of new ways to go from the ground up. According to Lester Brown, buildings use up to 72% of all electricity and contribute 38% of human-made carbon dioxide emissions. Yet we continue to make the equivalent of gas-guzzling buildings by failing to use advances in construction techniques. Today you will hear about super low-energy construction, buildings that reduce climate change while saving big time on energy costs. How to build homes, apartments, and commercial buildings that use up to 85% less energy. It's a European technique called passive house. Guido Wimmers is a passive house expert with many buildings to his credit in his native Austria. He came to Canada partly to oversee the construction of a model building called Austria House for the 2010 Winter Olympic Games. Austria House barely sips energy, even in the cold winter climate of Whistler, the famous ski resort. It is now Canada's foremost example of super energy efficiency. Guido, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you so much.
I don't think most North Americans really know what passive house is. Could you explain the basics for us?
Passive house is a building standard which is just focusing preliminary on the energy consumption. The very first, or let's say the most important ancestor of passive house is actually coming from Canada. It's the Saskatchewan Conservation House, built in 1977. And a few years later, a German physicist took these kind of idea and translated it into German and worked on this one and coined the German word passive house. So from there on, there was a kind of a clear definition what a passive house should be in terms of energy consumption requirements, energy density, airtightness, heat bridges, and all related things. And the very first one was built in 1991 in Germany, and from there on the movement grows. Right now we have roughly about 20,000 or a little bit over 20,000 units built so far. And now also the very first official certified passive house in Canada.
And what are the numbers behind this? If you could just give us a brief outline of what the house has to meet.
The most important one is the energy density, which means how much energy do you need to heat or cool your house. And this is 15 kilowatt hours per square meter.
Is that annually, or how is that measured?
Yeah, that's annually. So 15 kilowatt hours per square meter per year. So you take your floor space and multiply it with the kilowatt hours, so you get your total bill, for example.
Right. So I may have already misled our listeners a little bit, because passive house in German doesn't really just mean housing. You're talking also about offices and municipal buildings and so on, aren't you?
Right, yeah. The whole thing started with a smaller residential one. The very first one was a fourplex, for example. But since then, I was involved in schools, in office buildings, in institutional buildings, whole kind of different buildings are possible. We still call them passive house because that's just the original word for it.
Do these buildings still need a furnace or air conditioning?
They need some heating, yeah. So it's not a net zero. You minimized your energy consumption by 90%, but there's still 10% left, so we still need a system to deal with the last 10%. So this could be a very small heat pump or other systems are possible, but you still need some heating or some kind of heating system for the winter. But just this one could be a very, very small one.
And I think in one of your talks you mentioned, I think it was an office building in Europe, where you'd put in an air conditioning unit, but then it never needed to be used.
Right. This was an office building actually for the hydropower supplier of a province in Austria. So they invested into a new office building and built that one as a passive house. We've had, originally everybody thought, okay, we need some cooling as well. But it turned out because the envelope was really good built. So first of all, very good insulation, no heat bridges, and kind of smart way to deal with solar heat gain. So we have never had the problem to go into overheating in summer. So at the end, the office building, there was not the necessity to cool it. At least not over 4 years, or I think 5 years now, the building is in business.
You know, this is interesting. I talked to a fellow in Massachusetts who had tried to build something close to passive house standards, and he mentioned that they had put in heat pump that was fairly expensive, and now he's looking back and thinking that it added quite a bit to the cost of the house, and they really use it so seldom. He's wondering if they could have just put in a couple of electric heating panels or something and saved quite a bit on it.
Yeah, we have seen that in the past quite a few times, because people usually don't believe that the heating or cooling power that you at the end need is really that small or not existent. So people want to spend some money into backup systems because they don't need the calculations. But the calculation tool we use, the PHPP, the Passive House Planning Package, is, just from my experience, one of the most accurate programs. So you can really more or less rely on the results.
I guess one of the things that bothers me, there's a lot of confusing green standards out there. Could you just tell us how Passive House compares to, say, LEEDs or net zero buildings?
LEED is a very holistic system, so LEED focuses on a whole bunch of different things. That's not so with Passive House. Passive House is clearly focusing on the energy consumption. LEED is giving the energy chapter roughly 25% of all credits, Passive House 100%. There are a whole bunch of studies out there which say that 85% of the environmental impact of a building over its lifetime are caused by its energy consumption. So I think it makes sense to focus more on energy consumption, but that does not mean that we should forget or don't care about all the other issues. To understand Passive House, it's important to understand where it's actually coming from. A lot of issues which are related to other environmental things like toxic materials or whatever, these materials are forbidden in codes and bylaws in Germany, Austria, and a whole bunch of European states anyway. So LEED still makes a lot of sense for North America because the codes are relatively weak. So you still need a system like LEED to get a very good overall performance. Passive House compared to net zero, I would just simply say that's precondition. You need a very good building to save as much energy as you can, roughly 90%. And then if you want to go with net zero, you need something to generate the last 10% of your energy, which means a passive house with some photovoltaics on top of your roof, for example, can easily qualify as a net zero building.
Last weekend, I recorded a workshop you gave at the Sustainable Building Center in Vancouver, and later I'll tell listeners how to get a copy of that. You surprised me several times in the contrast between construction ideas in Europe versus North America. For example, here we consider all prefabricated buildings to be lower quality, like mobile homes or something, compared to those that are made on location. Why should real low-energy buildings be prepared in a factory?
There are two major issues. One is efficiency and the other one is accuracy. Efficiency in that term that when you go for prefab and work in a shop, you can work more precise and produce less waste. On site, you cannot work that precise, so the result is at the end, usually you also produce more waste. It's not just the waste, but you bought the material initially, so it's just more efficient in terms of investing your money. The second thing is accuracy. We talk about buildings without heat bridges and very airtight buildings. This kind of accuracy, simply you cannot achieve on site, so you have to go with prefab.
So people are setting up jigs or some sort of forms, and they're making sure that everything is right down to the millimeter so they fit super tight. Is that what you're saying? All right, well, one other surprise. You recommend heavy use of wood in construction, just when North American Greens have been demanding lower wood use to save our forests. What are the benefits of using wood?
First of all, I'd like to mention that solid wood panels are not mandatory or preconditioned or whatever from Passive House. Passive House is a system which works with pretty much all types of construction. Could be stick frame, could be brick, could be concrete, or could be solid wood. But beside that, solid wood buildings, so include more wood instead of less wood into our buildings, I think is a very smart thing in a long-term view. As long as we harvest our forests sustainable, it really makes sense to put more wood in our buildings from a climate perspective, because we store CO2, from a perspective to give the forest more value, because if we buy more wood, the forest industry will make sure that everything will be replanted and so on. And in the building itself, it's a very positive impact as well. You get more or less the behavior of concrete, but without the environmental impact of concrete. So instead of using very CO2-intensive building material like concrete, using a carbon-neutral material like wood makes totally sense. The positive impact on your building itself is the thermal mass. Wood has quite a bit of thermal mass. The humidity control function of wood wood can manage humidity. The noise reduction, very equal to concrete. And these are very, very positive impacts on the well-being inside your building. And even in terms of fire resistance, solid wood panels are actually very good.
Our guest is Guido Wimmers, an expert in the passive house design system. There are two common worries that I hear about air-sealed buildings. The first is they may rot, like our leaky condos here in Vancouver. Can you address that?
Well, air-sealed is not the same like vapor-tight. So these are two different issues. With air, we're talking about, well, air moving through our envelope. If we would allow air move into our envelope, then warm air is going through our envelope and transports humidity, water, with it in form of vapor. On the way out, it will reach the dew point and condensate, which means with that air movement, we transport humidity into our building envelope. So airtightness is a precondition to get rid of leaky condo. Leaky condos are leaky condos because they haven't been airtight. Vapor diffusion or vapor break or being vapor tight is something totally different. We don't have to be. As long as water stays as vapor, it's not a problem. It just gets a problem in that moment when it turns liquid. And this is the other issue what we have seen with the leaky condo crisis. We have a lot of condensation in these walls, water which is actually coming from the inside. True, quite a bit of these damages are caused by cracks and failures on the outside. But quite a bit of that humidity was actually coming from the inside. Vapor-tight buildings are not necessary, because if I design something which is more vapor diffusion open, I'm actually a little bit more on the safe side, because then I allow some failures or whatever on the building side, and no building is perfect. So this is something very, very different. Vapor open, yes, or vapor diffusion open is a very good thing, but it has to be airtight.
The second concern, I'm sure you've heard it too many times, that it isn't healthy indoors without a lot of air exchange. They talk about sick building syndrome. How do you handle that?
So airtightness is basically focusing on the envelope itself. So I don't want to have any air movement in my construction. But that does not mean that I cannot have sufficient air movement for my building itself. It's just easier to control, because I can control it with opening the window or closing the window. Or even better, if I have a ventilation unit with heat recovery. It's not comparable with a forced air system some people are used to. It's just a ventilation system with heat recovery, and that manages that I always have sufficient air, but without the negative impacts of losing too much moisture in your air, for example, because then the air gets too dry and it's just unhealthy. Sick building syndrome describes a whole bunch of different issues. Some I already mentioned, that the mold in the wall, because if you have leaked water, then it becomes moldy. It's basically the idea, and that's also precondition in a passive house, that you have a very hygienic, high-quality air inside your house, and therefore you need an air change in the range of 0.3 to 0.5 times per hour. That's roughly what we humans know, that this is the hygienic level, so enough oxygen in your air all the time, and even if there are some toxic gases or whatever, you get rid of that very fast.
I've only talked to two people who have lived in something equivalent to a passive house, and both of them raved about being in there. They say that the temperature is very steady no matter where you are in the house, and that they like the air quality. Is that the kind of feedback you get?
Yes, absolutely. I was involved in a whole bunch of different types of passive houses, from small residential to mid-size residential to institutional office buildings, school buildings, and so on. And honestly, I never got negative feedback. All people who have the chance to work in something like that or to live in something like that have never regretted.
Another surprising thing for me in your workshop, when we have a cold northern climate, or whether we're in a hot place in the south that needs air conditioning, I've always kind of thought of windows as a hole in the wall where energy escapes, but you design full floor-to-ceiling windows facing south. What do we need for real energy-efficient windows?
Well, windows are, from my personal point of view, the most underestimated building components in North American building industry. Windows are extremely important. They are crucial to the to achieving passive house standards in several different ways. First of all, as you already said, I think most windows are actually a hole in the wall. So it is very important to get a very decent quality for your windows. And it's not just the glass. It's even more difficult to achieve a very good quality in your frame. So with windows, you have a very positive, or you can have a very positive impact on your energy balance. They are still the weakest part in your envelope. So yes, you have to optimize them just to minimize your energy losses. But on the other side, they are the only part where you passively can harvest solar heat gain. And that's basically also the major idea of passive house. First of all, save as much energy as possible. And then just with the type of architecture and the orientation and so on, you try to, so to say, harvest free solar heat in the winter from the sun. But you just want to have that in the winter and not in the summer. That means the easiest way to harvest your energy is the southern facade. Because in summertime, the sun is in a relatively high angle, which means that a lot of the sunlight is reflecting on your window. And even better, if you have a small overhang or something like that, a simple shading system, don't have to be active, can just be an overhang. You get rid of the sun in summertime, so you don't run into the problem of overheating. So the orientation of the windows is crucial. South is by far the best way to put the windows in. We need still something in east and west and north just to get enough natural daylight, and maybe sometimes you have a very nice view to this direction. But however, the quality of windows is very crucial, and this is the biggest difficulty we have today in the North American market, because there are just a very few windows out in the market which are decent quality. And there's none so far, at least none which is produced in North America, which achieves the passive house standard. So this is something the industry, I'm very sure, will work on over the next year. So we will see the first production facilities for passive house windows, I hope. But that's basically the most underestimated part in your envelope. You need triple pane glass, that's precondition, and you need an insulated frame. And the frame should be, I think, made out of a sustainable material. So personally for me, wood is more or less the only choice. You can have an aluminum cladding just to achieve long-lasting windows, but for the structural part itself, I would always prefer wood.
We haven't really talked about your show project here in Canada, Austria House. Can you describe the intended use and a little bit about how it was built?
Well, the Austria House was a very long story. It started now 3.5 years ago when we introduced the idea to the mayor of Whistler just to contribute as the Austrian nation to the first Green Olympics ever, so to build a legacy for Whistler. And it turned out that this building is truly a very nice legacy for Whistler itself. So last Monday we have had a little conference in Whistler, and that was the official takeover from the Austrians to the municipality of Whistler. So now they are the owner of the building. This building was hosting the Austrian Olympic team and the broadcaster during the games. And now the municipality took over. As far as I know, they want to put in the kind of a commercial enterprise to rent cross-country skis and mountain bikes in winter and summer. And the second floor will be the clubhouse for the cross-country skiers in the winter and the clubhouse for the mountain bikers in the summertime.
So if you're in the Pacific Northwest, you could visit Austria House, listeners, and just go up to Whistler and poke around there. And also there's a blog about it. You can find a link to that in my Radio EcoShock blog dated April 1st, 2010. Guido, you told the workshop about ambitious plans to make super energy efficient construction perhaps the standard here in Canada by 2020. Do you think that could happen?
Well, let's put it that way. This is a very ambitious goal. So we have had quite a few different discussions with people in the city of Vancouver, with people on a government level, provincial government level. So this is a very ambitious goal to implement passive house criteria in the code by 2020. If that will happen, I don't know. We will see. But at least I really appreciate that these people begin to discuss into that direction. So I think there is an awareness that we have to work on that issue and push more into efficiency, because at the end it's just in our best interest for our society.
Guido, what is coming up for you? Can you tell us about any of the projects that you're working on?
I have quite a busy time these days because I just recently started my own company, Building Evolution, and I'm working on several different other passive houses. Unfortunately, the way it looks like, none of these will be finished this year, so they all finish at the beginning of next year. But we will see more residential buildings, and we will see very likely the first passive house winery in the world built in the Okanagan Valley.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Guido Wimmers, an Austrian-trained architect now working in Canada. He is spreading the idea of passive house, buildings which barely use any energy for heating or cooling. Find out more at buildingevolution.ca. Guido, I really appreciate your willingness to share so much of your good knowledge with our listeners.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You can get two free workshops by Guido Wimmers as MP3 files from the Radio EcoShock website. The first is titled Building Sanity from the program June 13, 2008. Find that in our program archives at ecoshock.org. Guido's most recent workshop is a full hour and a half, recorded March 20, 2010, at the Sustainable Building Center in Vancouver, Canada. For convenience, I've broken that down into two MP3 files available from our Cities page. Just go to ecoshock.org. Scroll down to the Audio On Demand menu on the lower left. Select Cities. You will find the Passive House workshop there. Incidentally, Passive House is spelled PASSIVHAUS. Lots of resources there for you to follow up.
With the floor, two front windows, one front door. Put on the roof right at the top. Don't forget you've got to have a chimney pot.
There is another good idea in development in the United States. What if we could capture the heat from the sun in our windows? That's the idea behind solar mass windows. I caught up with a builder testing them out. Let's go to Massachusetts now for super energy efficient building ideas from Tom Pitsley. Tom has a couple of videos up on YouTube of a very innovative home built in New England. From the outside, it looks like a normal house. Inside, it's a different story. Even the windows act like solar furnaces. Tom, can you describe this test house and what you hope to accomplish with it?
Sure. Well, the idea is that we wanted to build a house that looked normal, was very energy efficient from the start, and then utilize passive solar to offset the heating costs here in Massachusetts' cold climate. So we did that through a innovative window system that's being developed that actually stores the sun's energy in the window rather than in a floor or thermal mass like a traditional passive solar home.
So these windows actually have water in between two panes, I guess it is, and the sun heats them up. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so the product's been developing for a number of years. It was originally used several years ago in the MIT Solar Decathlon house where they had a plastic block that had aerogel insulation. That was one innovation, and then it's developed through the blocks that you saw in the videos, which are special exterior glazing and then water-filled blocks. And it's currently evolved into its newest form, which is rather than water, they use a hydrogel encapsulated in the glass as the thermal storage mechanism.
So the sun comes up, it hits these big windows that are facing directly south. Why does the warm air move into the house and not just come back out the window out the front?
All right. So there's several pieces to this window system that's totally unique in passive solar design. The exterior glazing of this unit has a combination of glazings and special low-E coatings that allow it to have a very good insulating value of about a 0.2 U value. And then it also has a very high solar heat gain coefficient of a 0.72. So you get the best of both worlds on the exterior glazing in that you have a very high insulating and you also have a very high solar heat gain glass.
And do these windows also collect the cold at night? Are they emitting cold air into the house on a winter morning?
No, so it has it's much better insulating value. The U value is much lower than even an Energy Star rated window. So the insulation value of the window is much higher than a regular window. But it allows a lot more of the solar energy, probably 225 to 250% of what a normal Energy Star rated window would provide into your house.
And so if I'm standing in front of those windows on a sunny day, even if it's 50, 60 degrees outside, I'm going to feel warmth from the windows.
Well, so what happens is now that sun comes through that exterior glazing and strikes another mass of glass. So there's another two layers of glass. So there's a total of four layers of glass in the windows. The inner two layers are spaced 1 inch apart and contain a hydrogel encapsulated between these two layers that actually stores the sun's energy in that gel mass that's located in the window pane.
And you can still see out through them like a normal window.
You can still see out like a normal window. They're tinted. The tinting helps to capture more of the solar energy in the mass. And what happens is over the course of the day, and the same thing happened with the water windows, over the course of the day they slowly heat up and capture the solar energy. Where we had days at the end of, if you saw the video then, we had a day last March that was 34 degrees outside. The windows actually reached 115 degrees the temperature within the water in that window. And then it just slowly radiates that heat into the space because the insulation value of the exterior glazing is so good that it takes the path of least resistance, which is into the living space.
Okay, so you wanted to tell me about another project that you have upcoming?
So in order to control this solar energy, which you want to be able to shut it off at certain times of the year or certain times of the day, you know, traditional design is to build overhangs on your house. Sometimes they're kind of ugly looking, sometimes they're too big. They don't always work effectively because the sun's not always at that angle. It's low in the sky early in the morning, late in the day. So as part of this window system, they've developed an exterior solar shade. And the latest version actually incorporates that into the head of the window, and then it actually is mechanically designed to be operated off of a thermostat. So you can actually set a room thermostat that will automatically drop your window shades and shut the sun's energy off when it starts to get too warm in your living space.
Would you still be able to see out the window?
The shades have, they're kind of like a Venetian blind. They have a fixed angle, and they're separated, so you can't see out the window somewhat, but it's like looking through a Venetian blind that's partially opened, and it does, cut some of the natural light down. But what happens is they're spaced and they're angled in a way that the sun never actually touches the glass. And you're able to control the solar energy in that way. So you can put more of these in than you would normally do in a passive solar home and have total control over the way the solar energy is actually, transferred into your house.
Right. And was there something else you wanted to tell me about?
So there's another project coming up this spring that's going to have 20 of these new solar windows into it. And it's actually going to have no central heating system installed in the house. It's going to have a wood stove as a backup, and that's about it.
That sounds perfect to me. What's the name of the company who's making the windows?
It's still a prototype, and it's kind of under a non-disclosure agreement. But it's being developed under Hunter Douglas, which is actually a window shade manufacturer. And their head of research and development has been working on this for a number of years. And it's about to really release a product that's going to change the way we look at that solar design.
But they're not on the market yet.
No, they're not. They're not currently on the market. We're installing several prototype versions of them in houses locally in the next year or so.
So it's possible somebody, if they wanted to be a test version or a guinea pig for this, might be able to contact you or the company and see about that.
Sure. Yeah. No, we're looking for test sites right now so we can actually get these on the market. I believe they're shipping a couple out to Colorado at this point in time to be tested on some solar homes out in that region as well. So.
And how big is this home that we're talking about?
So the house that you saw in the video was 2,000 square feet. It had a number of different other elements, and it had structural insulated panel for an envelope system to create a very good insulation. It had thermal mass, and it has a geothermal heating system to provide what heat isn't being provided through passive solar energy.
And how does the home compare with the passive house specifications?
We'll know exactly in another month or so. We're waiting for the full year's data to collect so we can tell the exact energy use needed by the home. It's all electric, so it's fairly easy to calculate that energy use. So we can simply read the meter, and that'll be coming up in the next month or so. We'll actually be doing a video where we shoot with the interview with the homeowner, and do a little bit of update on exactly how the house formed.
How is the homeowner reacting? I mean, you're trying to control the air. You're having an air transfer. Is she feeling comfortable in the home?
Oh, she's absolutely loving it. What she likes is that on a cold winter's day that she comes home and the house is 74, 75 degrees inside, and the heat hasn't been on for 10 or 12 hours. Last month's heating bill here in Massachusetts for her was about $66 to heat that home through the geothermal system that was needed to supplement the passive solar energy. So that was last month, and we haven't got the full year's data there again. That was just the heating load for the house. So to heat the home here in New England, a 2,000-square-foot house, cost about $66 last month.
That is crazy cheap, really, and you've just had a fairly cold winter compared to previous winters, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's been that cold this year. I think it has been fairly moderate this year. So, regardless of that, it's still pretty good in comparison to most houses.
Now, what about the construction cost? Did it cost a lot more to build this one?
I would say it was about $30,000 to $40,000 additional to what it would have cost to build a traditional home. There were a number of elements between the structural insulated panels. The geothermal heating system is a fairly expensive option that may not have been, in the long term, the most cost-effective or the highest payback number, because it was fairly expensive to install, and it really isn't used that much. So a less expensive system may have been a better option at that for providing the heat to the home.
Good point. And then we have to add the 20 or 10-year cost of all those energy savings compared to a conventional home, so that at some point there has to be, especially since we're heading maybe into peak oil and dwindling oil supplies, it could be a real payoff to have a home like this.
Right. So we're trying to get the cost down. I mean, every one we do, we get a little better at. We get a little more efficient with. We find ways to reduce the energy costs. You know, this particular house was designed for all electric use, so that it could be converted to zero energy at some point in the future with solar panel. And we haven't. Once we at the end of the year, we'll kind of get a better idea of what it would cost to convert this house to total zero energy, so we can actually calculate out the total yearly energy cost and size of the system to meet that need.
Right. The roof is oriented to the south and slanted correctly, so you can just add solar panels at a later time if you want to.
Exactly. And that was done intentionally in the design phase of the house, so to start, the house was designed to maximize solar energy and to be as efficient as possible.
Are you hearing more about other net zero homes or passive house buildings in the United States?
Yeah, there's more and more talk about them. There's a guy local here in Massachusetts that's actually trying to convert houses to zero energy or passive standards. It's a lot more difficult in existing housing stock than it is to do it in new construction. But people are trying, you know. They've been trying for a while, and they're getting better at it. And, certain climates are more, it's easier to reach that point of zero energy or passive house scheme.
Can you give us a couple of spots on the web where listeners can go to find out more?
Sure. Well, they're welcome to visit my website. It's www.eebt.org. There should be plenty of links there where you can find out more information, as well as the Passive House Institute.
The Passive House Institute, right. Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put all the links that people need on my Radio EcoShock blog entry for April 1st, 2010. Just click blog at ecoshock.org to get that. From Massachusetts, our guest has been Tom Pitsley. Tom, good luck with your project, and I hope it helps revolutionize home energy use in the United States.
Great. Thank you very much.
Tom Pitsley's website is eebt.org. That's eebt.org. I put links to a couple of videos of this New England project clearly showing the solar mass windows in my Radio EcoShock blog entry for April 1st, 2010. Just go to ecoshock.org and then click on blog.
I got more. I'm a
above. Got an open heart and I've got love. My wood is sound, my nails on a rust. I got a man whom I can trust. More than a hammer, more than a nail. Talking about a man who will never fail. I fell down along my way. He picked me up and now I can say more than a hammer and nail.
I've been building a low-energy home in my head for several years now. We have already purchased a retreat property in one of Canada's few desert-like areas where there is lots of sunshine. Everything I research tells me we are headed for a time when energy will be very, very expensive and probably rationed. Folks who can get into an energy-efficient home with their own power supply, whether solar or wind, should be able to cope comfortably, especially if you can grow some food as well. But even if most of us stay in the city and what we've got, energy efficiency will still be very important. Look to replace old windows with triple glazed models with low leak frames. If possible, put big ones facing south. And you can tighten up all those leaky holes around foundations, water intake pipes, doors and roof joints. Insulate, insulate. Here is a tip from a country boy. Mice can get through a crack the size of a pencil. True fact. Somehow their bones mesh enough to get past these tiny holes. If you fill holes with foam, the mice eat right through, but not if you first stuff the crack or hole with steel wool and then blast it with expandable foam. Mice don't like to chew through steel, so you'll save on heating and cooling costs by filling those holes while keeping the vermin out. At the start of this program, Guido Wimmers told us energy use in buildings accounts for at least 80% of their impact on the environment. But as an architect with the European sensitivity, Guido still takes care to use materials that won't damage the earth or leak poisons into the building. Now we're going to sample another workshop from Vancouver's Sustainable Building Center. This time, Jamie DeSimone describes a building project she did near Peterborough, Ontario, creating an environmental teaching center using wood and straw bale technology. Jamie isn't an architect. She just did a course on sustainable building, which resulted in a 2,000-square-foot structure at Camp Kawartha. I recorded this on March 13, 2010. You will hear excerpts, and remember, you can download the whole thing from the city's page of ecoshock.org.
I come from Ontario. I just moved out here about 6 months ago to try and be a part of this wonderful green movement that Vancouver is so well known for. I come from a science background, environmental science, so I did an undergrad and a master's degree in environmental science. And I just wasn't really satisfied with the kind of research that I was doing. It was more really, I mean, you write papers and people read the papers and they're just, it's not very applicable to everyday life. And so I really wanted to get into something that really made a difference. And so I took a course, which I'll be talking to you about today, where we built this awesome building. So we built this great straw bale building, super sustainable, net zero energy, and so I'll go through all of that with you guys. And I just want to say that totally changed the way I think about buildings, the way I think about sustainability, and I think it was an amazing experience, and so that's definitely where my career is going, in the direction my career is going in. This is so encouraging. I love that everybody's so interested in natural building. That's awesome. Hopefully we can make some big changes here. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about the impacts of buildings, building materials and embodied energy, which is something we should really consider when we're putting together a building and choosing materials, and then the Camp Kawartha experience. That's the majority of the talk. So Stan, the first person that introduced himself, mentioned something about the impacts that we have here on the planet. I think right now, on average, we're taking up about 1.4 Earths. So we're obviously using way more than we should be using, and so we really have to consider building differently and changing the way that we see buildings and the way that we use them. So how much time of our lives do we North Americans spend in buildings? Anyone have a guess? A percentage? Absolutely. 90% of our lives we spend. That's huge. No, that's a really, really, really big number. Even, I mean, we live out in BC, a lot of people like to spend time hiking and camping and things like that, but the majority of us spend about 90% of our lives in buildings, and that's, when we see how much buildings and their occupants use of our natural resources, that's a huge number. So we use about 17% of the world's water resources, 25% lumber, 40% of our raw materials, and 54% of our energy. And so the population of the Earth has doubled in the past 45 years. So now we're almost at 7 billion. It used to be about 3.5 billion 45 years ago, and we're expected to double again in the next 50 years or so. So buildings already use so much, and we're building more, and there's more people on the planet, and so we really, really, really have to consider the way that we use them and what we're building with. So according to the UN, the world is undergoing the largest wave of urban growth in history, and so we have, as of 2008, more than half the world's population lives in towns and cities, and we're building them like concrete jungles, people often refer to. So we have a lot of impervious surfaces, we have a lot of water running off, we have a lot of pollution being caused. Arguably, water is the most important resource on the planet. Every single living organism needs water, and we're treating it really, really poorly, especially with the way that we build. So some of the consequences, referring specifically to water, of the current urban development are obviously taking up land resource, and resources for growing food, and food security is a big issue right now. We have flooding, obviously. There's impervious surfaces. Water has nowhere to go, but we also have stormwater management problems. So we have something called combined sewer overflow. A lot of cities, the municipalities, they have one tube for all of our sewage and stormwater to go through. And so when we have a huge storm flow, all of the stormwater and sewage water gets mixed up together. And if it's too much, then it bypasses the sewage treatment plant because there's too much water to go all the way through it. And that happens fairly often. And so all that water, all that mix of water, all the pollution from the impervious surfaces, like the gas, the oil, everything that's on the ground that gets washed into the sewers, and also all of our sewage water just bypasses and it gets into our rivers, lakes, and streams. And according to some scientific measures, the most important pollution, or the strongest point of pollution in coastal environments is stormwater pollution. So that's obviously really important, especially here in Vancouver. So we've definitely interrupted our water balance in the way that we're building right now. And so this is just an example of how we've changed the water balance. So if we have one family home on a plot, we have 100% water coming down, and let's say 50% falls on the lawn, 30% falls on the roof, and 20% falls on their driveway surfaces, the paved surfaces. So if we consider runoff coefficients, we consider evapotranspiration, stuff like that, we have about 60% of that water running off. And instead of percolating into the ground, instead of being uptaken by plants and stuff, it's just going straight off into our sewers. If we convert our homes or build differently, so we build a little bit more green, we have maybe a green roof, we have rain water collection, rain barrels, rain gardens, things that can collect water and allow water to percolate and have pervious pavements as well, so water can actually infiltrate into the ground where it's supposed to go. We can reduce that to about 7%, which is a huge reduction, and it doesn't take very much to be able to do that. So that's also something we should consider when we're considering building. So buildings use up a lot of non-renewable or very slowly renewable materials, and we're only building more buildings as populations increase. So the consequences of unsustainable urban development can be really devastating, as we can see with floods and things like that. So I think really, the need for building sustainably is quite undeniable, and I don't really have to tell you guys that, but this is, you know, I'm kind of preaching to the choir, I think, right now, but it's important to talk about. So the term sustainability, it means meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And we often think about this in the environmental sphere and just talk about environmental sustainability, but I think what we really need to talk about as well is economic and social sustainability. And so when we have all these three spheres of sustainability actualized, this center portion where all three meet is where we can really achieve true sustainability. And this is also considered the triple bottom line. So when we're talking about materials that we're using for building, we can look at the life cycle of the materials. So we have raw material extraction, manufacture, transportation, assembly and installation, disassembly, deconstruction, and or hopefully decomposition. And so we call this the life cycle of material. We can also call it the cradle to cradle thing. So we're looking at how materials are manufactured and how they get back to the raw material point. And then we can also call this embodied energy. So we can do calculations of all these different parts of where a material comes from, and we can add a value to it and compare different materials based on this embodied energy value. And the value is a joule, so an energy per kilogram per mass. And this is an example of a table of a bunch of embodied energy values. So the building that we built, which I'll talk to you about, is a straw bale and has a really, really low embodied energy because it's a waste product from agriculture. So it's already being produced. It's really easy. It's really light. It's easy to transport. And it decomposes when you're done with it. So it's got a really good cradle-to-cradle system. And things that we use like aluminum, fiberglass, and polystyrene insulation, those have really high embodied energies. And paper even has a pretty high embodied energy, as well as PVC and HDP, which a lot of our piping and stuff is made from. No, it's the whole cycle of the... Yeah, it definitely includes that, yeah. Concrete, it's the most intensive part of... Not necessarily intensive, but concrete, the cement, Portland cement is... Yeah, it's the greenhouse gas emissions, which the embodied energy doesn't take into account necessarily greenhouse gases. But you're right, Portland cement, 1 ton of Portland cement produced is 1 ton of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is ridiculous. So, yeah, that's definitely something to consider as well. So there's all kinds of things you need to look at, but it's overwhelming to look at everything that you can possibly look at. So this is just one possibility of a measure. So the project I'm going to talk about is the Camp Kawartha Education Center, Environmental Education Center. And the program, the school program is through Fleming College, and it was called Sustainable Building Design and Construction. And basically we did just that. We built a building in about 4.5 months, and there were 26 of us, and each student had to choose 3 things that they were in charge of, one mechanical, one structural, and one administrative. That's it. So all of us had a task that we were responsible for and that we were in charge of doing. And this was an amazing course. I definitely recommend if anyone is interested in knowing a little bit more about sustainable building and natural building and actually get a hands-on idea of how it works. It was only 5 months, and it's in Ontario, unfortunately, but it's in a place called Peterborough, and it's easy to find places to live there for a couple of months, and it's an amazing, amazing, amazing place. And the teacher who teaches the course is like a straw bale guru. He wrote this book. If you guys are interested, it's more straw bale building. He wrote also straw bale building. This is the second one, Chris Magwood. This is something David Suzuki said about this building and about environmental education in general. And David Suzuki is one of my heroes. I love him. The great challenge of our time is to reconnect ourselves with the world around. It is the biosphere that is our home, and our most fundamental need is clean air, water, soil, and energy, and the diversity of life to deliver these basic needs. Most children today grow up in cities where we focus on the economy. We have to change this focus. I think he just hits a nail on the head there, absolutely. And so one of the things this building did for me was demystify building construction. I think that's a really, really important thing when we're talking about sustainability. We're talking about kind of being a part of your building. So, like, what's behind that wall? And now I have an idea what's behind that wall. And if I needed to fix something, I would have an idea of where to go and how to do it and what to look at. And I think that that's really important. I mean, we spend 90% of our lives in buildings, and a lot of that time is spent in our homes. So we're kind of like snails. We've got our houses on our backs. And I think it's important to think of buildings as kind of like an extension to ourselves. And if we do that, and if we understand the way buildings are built, and understand that they are a part of us, then I think that we'll treat building a little bit more differently, and we'll kind of make it more sustainable because we want to be more sustainable in our lives as well. So we're decreasing our footprint by decreasing the footprint of the building, the place that we live. So I encourage you to be a do-it-yourselfer. There's so many great books out there just to learn a little bit more about what you're doing. So these are some of the features of the building. There's lots. I'm going to go through all of these and a little bit more. So net zero energy design, supplying back to the grid at peak demand hours, grid-tied solar panel, passive solar design, prefabricated and built on-site straw bale walls, geothermal heating and cooling, radiant floor, living roof, solar hot water, rainwater collection, indoor constructed wetlands, straw bale, hempcrete, slip straw, and composting toilets. A lot of stuff, a lot of really great products that we used. So in terms of passive solar design, I know this is a really busy diagram, but I just want to point out a couple things here. So these are our floor plans, and if you see all the blue lines are the walls, and then where there's a break in the blue line, there's either a window or a door. So in the top part of your image, there's the round wall, and that's facing south, and then the bottom part is facing north. So there's 2 doors in the north and 3 small windows. And in the south, you see 2 large windows on either side, and then 5 windows in the round area. And so windows are obviously very important when you're talking about passive solar design. You want to have sun that comes into the building and that in the wintertime is able to heat up a thermal mass So obviously it's very important to have a thermal mass in your home. And that will then radiate that heat, that energy back out in the evening time when the sun goes down and when it gets cooler outside. And the most important thing about passive solar design, because in the summertime it can get really hot if you have too much sun. So you really have to have a good overhang system or something that hangs over your windows in order to not get too much sun in during the daytime. So this building is the Environmental Education Center that we built, like two different classrooms at a time, and they can all come in, and there's a bunch of displays and stuff set up as well. So this is an example of a good passive solar design. So you have that overhang that stops the summer sun from coming in too far into the building. And then in the winter sun, because it's a lot lower in the sky, then it can penetrate into the building, and it heats up a thermal mass, which in this case, it's the floors. Our floors are concrete, about 2.5 inches of concrete, and that acts as a really good thermal mass. You can also have a wall that's a thicker wall against where the sunlight would come in, and that would act as a good thermal mass as well. So the foundation, I think this is one of the coolest parts of the building, and I think it's something that can be incorporated into conventional building. But so basically we had a floating perimeter beam on a concrete, on a gravel bed. The gravel bed is about a foot deep or so, maybe 14 inches, and we built a form in the top right corner. You can see the form that goes around the perimeter. And we just poured the concrete in there. But before we did that, we added sonotubes, 6-inch sonotubes at 1-foot centers all the way along the concrete, or all the way along the form, and reinforced it all with rebar. And that was to displace about 35% of the concrete that we were pouring in there. Because right in the center portion, you don't need any concrete. It doesn't do anything for the stability of the structure. So it's wasteful to have it there. So we decided to totally displace it. And also, instead of using Portland cement, we used 50% slag, which is a byproduct from the steel industry, and it's just waste material. It works very similarly to Portland cement, and because it's a waste material, it's much more sustainable to use. So we were able to displace a lot of the Portland that we used. Yeah, it's the same thing. Fly ash, yeah. Exactly. Approximately, yeah. We just tamped it with a motorized tamper, went all the way around the whole thing. And so we made it, because we have a bunch of different wall systems, we made the width of the perimeter different at each different section of the building. We also used earthbag foundation, and I had never heard of it before, and I think it's such an amazing idea. Basically, we had these bags, like you can see in the top picture here, with it's like a rice bag almost, like a plastic weaved bag, and we just added a mixture of A gravel, a bit of slag, and some water. Just mixed it up in a mixer, and then you pour it in, and you just tamp this down, and it creates a really, really strong, stable foundation. And we could have used it for the entire foundation of the building. The reason that we didn't was our teacher thought that it wouldn't be flat enough to put our prefabricated walls, which I'll show you in a second, that need a really flat surface. But it turned out that those were much flatter than the actual concrete that we used, and we had to come around with a hammer and a chisel to actually chisel the whole foundation. It was terrible. But anyways, I would definitely use earthbag foundation. It's amazing. And it's really good to do for round sides as well. So we stopped the perimeter beam at the round wall, and we use earthbag to do that instead.
A couple of things. Yep. When the bags degrade, is what's inside still staying together? Or
the bags don't degrade. That's one thing. They're not biodegradable.
The UV won't break them down?
They're covered. So, yeah, they're totally covered. And the UV probably would break it down, but it wouldn't be fast enough in the time that we're actually leaving them exposed. But they're fully covered once the building's finished.
That was Jamie DeSimone, a young woman who has specialized in net-zero building techniques. She was describing a 2,000-square-foot Camp Kawartha Environmental Center near Peterborough, Ontario. Jamie was part of a teaching project testing new and environmentally sustainable building materials and super low-energy techniques. For example, straw was used as the main insulation in the walls. This recording by Alex Smith was at the Lighthouse Sustainable Building Center in Vancouver, Canada. As a stimulus and teaching place for green building, the Lighthouse merges volunteers, young designers, and construction workers with the larger building industry. Find out more at sustainablebuildingcenter.com, and center is spelled C-E-N-T-R-E, the Canadian spelling. Download this workshop and another by Guido Wimmers as free MP3 files from the city's page at ecoshock.org. I hope you found some inspiration from these building pioneers. There is a long way to go. Vested interests and old-school building codes try to prevent the changes we need. But sooner or later, the ever-rising cost of energy and the awful cost to the climate will drive humans to step much more lightly on the earth, especially in the ways we seek shelter. I'm Alex. Thanks for listening.